Welcome to Drive Time Live, the Mills Crenshaw Show. It is 7 minutes past three, and this is a very special day. Sorry about that. It's 12-12-12. Gee, I don't know. If I were a betting man, I would think this would be a very propitious day. My in-studio guest is Dr. Mark Allen Wright, Assistant Professor of Ancient Scriptures at Brigham Young University. Welcome to K-Talk.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
First and foremost, let me make this disclaimer. You're not here as a representative of BYU or the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. You are here as an expert witness on the end of the world.
That's correct.
And, of course, we're only 9 days away from the apocalypse, as a lot of people are considering it. And I assume that you've had a little bit of interest in this?
I have, yeah. Yeah. Back in 2009, when that disaster flick came out, titled 2012, I was asked to write an article kind of debunking all the myths. And so ever since then, I've kind of had an active interest in it, and I've done interviews and spoken at conferences and whatnot about that, trying to, get people to not worry about it so much.
Well, you don't think then that everybody should sell their property quickly and have a big party?
Well, if they want to sell it cheap, send them my way. But the Maya themselves, I'll just say this right up front, the Maya themselves never made any prophecies about the end of the world. They never said the world was going to end in 2012 or in any other date for that matter.
Oh, heck. And here I thought we had this great scoop.
I know. Yeah, a lot of it's just based on a misunderstanding of the Maya hieroglyphs themselves, and then really just kind of a lot of New Agers kind of twisting the native Maya mythologies to suit their own ends, and a lot of them are making a lot of money on it, for that matter.
All right. I want to get some background first, and then we can open the phone lines and let the audience participate by asking you the questions that have been on their mind.
Okay.
First of all, I think there's a lot of confusion in people's minds about Aztec history and the Aztec glyphs and Mayan culture. Mm-hmm. Can you kind of unscramble that for us?
Yeah, so a lot of people do, they don't really disambiguate between the Maya and the Aztec. The Maya were a much earlier culture. The classic period Maya civilization was from about 250 AD, and then they collapsed around 900 AD. And we don't even see the appearance of the Aztec till about 1300 AD, and then they're really starting to peak in the 1500s when the Spaniards show up. And so they're separated by centuries, and they're also separated by several, almost 1,000 miles, give or take.
In that part of the world, that's a pretty fair piece.
Yeah, if you're hiking, I mean that's a pretty good journey. And so the Aztec are more in the central Mexican area, basically centered around where Mexico, modern Mexico City, is today. Whereas the Maya civilization, their peak was down in the lowlands of Guatemala, sort of northern Guatemala, going into kind of the Yucatan Peninsula. So very different peoples, different languages, different cultures. There are some shared cultural beliefs. They had different gods, different languages, different everything.
Their physiognomy was quite different as well. If I am correct, the Mayan people were noted by large proboscis and slope foreheads, or is that just an artifact?
Well, the oftentimes the noses, we used to think that the noses were, genetically different. But if you take a close look at some of the monuments or sculpture from Palenque, for example, you can actually see that they were wearing basically nose enhancers. I don't know what else to call them. And so they actually, you can see the details on them in some of the Maya monuments. But they would do that to change the shape of their nose. And then the sloped foreheads were actually a result of intentional cranial modification. They would actually bind the baby's heads to make them more conical, and they would do that to sort of mimic the shape of the corn god or the maize god's head. He was sort of an ideal of beauty, and they wanted to make themselves look like him. So it was royal. It was a royal modification. The commoners wouldn't be engaging in that. It was just really the royalty and the nobles.
And the large proboscis was an artifact, then they actually had enhancers.
Yeah, so I mean, they wouldn't surgically modify them or anything. It was just sort of this, almost like a, you know, a costume element, you know, like a fake nose that they would, you know, stick on there.
Now, Jimmy Durante would have been absolutely shocked by that.
Yeah. but yeah, so I mean, it, really the physical differences between them are really just more human made rather than genetic.
Okay. What about the cultural difference? Were the Aztecs more warlike?
They tended to be a little bloodier. We have this misconception that the Maya were sort of obsessed with heart sacrifice. We do have one or two monumental or depictions, or on some of the vases, they would intricately paint these small vases that they would drink hot chocolate out of. And there are a few depictions of human sacrifice. But nothing on the level of the Aztecs. So the Spaniards, when they, you know, were among the Aztec, they give some accounts of, you know, thousands upon thousands of people being sacrificed in a single day, and their bodies being rolled down the Templo Mayor, the main temple in Tenochtitlan, which is basically what Mexico City is built on right now. Now those numbers may be inflated because the Spanish maybe were trying to portray them as these savages, but at any rate, large-scale human sacrifice is happening among the Aztec, and there's no evidence for large-scale human sacrifice among the Maya.
Interesting. All right. If you were to be teaching a class and you wanted to differentiate between the two, give us your thumbnail description of the two different cultures.
Well, again, chronologically, if we look at Mesoamerica, we often think of the Olmec as the cultura madre, or the original culture of Mesoamerica, the first kind of great civilization. And all later civilizations are sort of, I don't want to say an outgrowth, but they were influenced by the Olmec. And so the next sort of great culture that most people know of is the Maya. The pre-classic Maya, they begin to flourish around 500 BC up until 200 AD. And then we get the classic period from about 250 to 900. And again, they're sort of centered in Guatemala. And then the Aztec are, you know, again, they're north by several hundred miles. They're later by several hundred centuries. And, you know, culturally, again, the Aztec tend to be a little bit bloodier. And they were a little more, I guess, hegemonic. They tried to influence a little more tighter control. For the Maya, they were never unified as a single people. Like, you know, in Egypt, you have the pharaoh that was pharaoh over all of Egypt. For the Maya, each city was kind of an entity unto itself. So there was no, well, we can't really call them the Maya. That's a designation we modern scholars have given to these ancient peoples. But the Maya of Palenque did not consider themselves to be even the same people as the Maya of Tikal or the Maya of Copan. Each one was their own sort of individual city-state, and they were constantly warring with each other. And the Aztec, in some ways, they tried to exert a little more influence over a larger area versus the Maya, who were more concerned with their just individual city-states. And that's sort of an oversimplification of it, but I think it speaks a little bit to the difference politically.
Yeah, but it does give us an insight that most of us don't have. There's this confusion between the two in many people's minds. Maybe I ought to just speak for myself. Maybe the audience is very well aware of all this.
But No, there's a lot of confusion between the two, especially when it comes to the calendar. A lot of people conflate the Aztec calendar with the Maya calendar. And so you see all the comics and cartoons that are going around, you know, Facebook or the Internet, talking about the Maya calendar ending, and they actually show the Aztec sunstone that's not even the Maya calendar. A fully developed writing system. They could, you know, record anything they wanted pretty much any way they wanted, whereas the Aztec, they had a their day glyphs, and they were able to represent basic names of cities or places, but they didn't have a fully developed writing system. They weren't writing in complete sentences like the Maya were.
Interesting. I've had other guests who purport that they can read the Mayan language. Mm-hmm. And how many extant codices are there actually? I only learned of maybe four.
Yeah, there's only four codices that exist, but we do actually have hundreds and hundreds of monuments. So these, we refer to these as stela, the large stone monuments with typically has like the king represented on the front, or maybe some other, maybe a mythological scene, and then it's the sides and sometimes the back are covered with hieroglyphs. So most of the texts we have from the classic period come from monuments or also these vases that I mentioned to you. We've got hundreds of these vases that are known, and they also have hieroglyphic inscriptions on them. Now, the codices are very, very late. It's late post-classic. By then, the writing system actually experienced something of a devolution. It was sort of less... it was less developed in the 1500s than it was in the 900s, because with the collapse of the Maya civilization in 900 came a collapse, a loss of knowledge, of the a large-scale loss of knowledge when it came to the writing system, and so we're able to read about 85 to 90% of the glyphs today, but there's still about 10 to 15% that resist decipherment.
Interesting. In your studies, have you come across anything that is like advertising, eat at Charlie's place?
No, but on the vases, all of them have a very similar text going along the top, and we refer to it as the primary standard sequence. And before we knew how to translate the glyphs, we thought it must have been some sort of a mystical incantation that had something to do with, you know, activating the life of this this cup. And once we were able to finally decipher it, there was always one glyph that was different. We never knew why. But it turns out that one glyph that's always different is a name glyph. And the inscription around it always says, this is the cup for drinking hot chocolate of, you know, so-and-so. And so these were literally hot chocolate cups. It says, Yukib Cacao, which is his cup for hot chocolate, or his cup for cacao.
So instead of coffee for these people, mm-hmm. it was chocolate.
Yeah, yeah. And so we have the Maya to thank for hot chocolate. So as you're sipping on your hot chocolate this Christmas, just remember to thank the Mayans.
Interesting. Now, was chocolate for them, was it combined with sugar, so it was a sweet, or was it a very bitter brew?
It was bitter. They would actually combine it sometimes with chili peppers. And so, yeah, it's very, very different. I've had one... taste of a supposedly Aztec-style hot chocolate anyway, and it wasn't to my liking. I'll leave it at that. But the Spaniards went crazy for it. They thought it was great, and, you know, and that's how the whole chocolate trade began, was the Spaniards began shipping it back to Europe.
Just as an aside, any history on when the idea of sweet chocolate came into being?
You know, I don't know. That's a good question.
I would think that would be a fascinating discovery. Of course, sweet chocolate has taken over the whole world.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I don't know of many cultures that eat chocolate or drink chocolate neat.
Right. Yeah, my wife prefers it a little darker, but when she buys the chocolate bars, but I'm more of a semi-sweet person myself.
Interesting. All right, we're coming up on a commercial break. What I want to do is give the audience a chance to call in and ask you questions. And, of course, we've been sort of tiptoeing around the Mayan calendar that a lot of people think predicts the end of the world in 9 days. And I sort of wanted to leave those questions for the audience, because some people may have some very specific questions. Telephone number to call in is 254-5855. Your questions to Dr. Mark Allen Wright, an expert on the Mayan culture. We'll be right back on KTalk AM 630, Utah's Talk Radio.
Jack and Diane painted a picture of my life and my dreams. Suddenly
AM 630 KTalk. Grab your phone and make the call. Drive Time Live with Mills Crenshaw.
324 in the Mountain West. My guest is Dr. Mark Allen Wright, an assistant professor at BYU who is a Mayan expert. Sandy, welcome to K-Talk. You're on with Dr. Wright.
Yeah, Dr. Wright, I had heard that with the Mayan calendar that they do it in increments of 57 years. And that there won't be another 57 years left, you know, the Earth as we know it, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's actually a kind of a common misconception. It's actually a 52-year cycle, and that's actually an Aztec cycle. That's not even the Maya cycle.
Oh, okay.
So for the Maya, their basic core unit of counting time was a 20-year period called a khatun.
Huh.
And their larger cycle is a 256-year cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And then the kind of the big cycle that's going to be, I hesitate to use the word ending, but I guess ending is the right word here in on the 21st, is it's 5,125 years. The conflation between the Maya and the Aztec calendar comes with this concept of destruction and renewal. So with these 52-year cycles among the Aztec, that actually kind of is based on what's known as the Aztec Leyenda de los Soles. It's the legend of the suns. And they had kind of these prior periods of four suns, and each one was a 52-year period. It was 52 times something. So one of them was 52 times 6. Another was 52 times 7. And so we're talking about centuries and centuries.
Uh-huh.
And each of the previous four creations were oriented to one of the world directions. So one of the east, one of the west, one of the north, one of the south. And because they were off-center, they were inherently unstable. But the current sun that we're in, the fifth sun, is actually balanced in the center. So for them, they had five world directions, north, south, east, west, and center. And so this fifth sun is balanced safely in the center. There's no need for destruction because it's in a safe place. And there's no talk of destruction or renewal with this fifth sun. Now, again, that's an Aztec legend. And that one, that 52-year cycle, the next one of those won't end until the year 2027. So we've got at least 15 more years before that comes to an end.
Okay. Yeah. Now, here's another thing. The cacao that they created, that's what they're using now in the health food stores. It's supposed to be an antioxidant.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
chocolate. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, many of their plants were used for medicinal as well as religious purposes as well. Yeah.
Right, yeah, and it has magnesium in it, and it's calming, and it's a feel-good thing. So that's...
Yeah, I know chocolate makes me feel good.
Yeah,
so.
It does. There you go. Okay, and I guess my concern is when we hit December 21st, the government could create some kind of a fear.
Well, you know, from what I've seen of, the government is actually trying to calm people down.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they don't want to create any kind of a panic. And, you know, if you go to the NASA website, for example, they kind of debunk all of the different, catastrophic scenarios that have been mm-hmm. played out. But
good. That's great, then.
Yeah.
Good. Okay.
Sandy, good call. Thank you.
You bet.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Kent, welcome to K-Talk.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. You're on with Dr. Mark Allen.
Males, I would like to ask
That's
you,
Mark Allen, right.
Yes.
Yeah. I would like to ask your guest a couple questions. First of all, I'd like to find out whether or not he's familiar with a book called When the Chinese Discovered the World.
I haven't read it, no. I mean, I've heard of it, but yeah, I haven't actually read that. I know there's a similar book, 1491. I'm not sure if that's. But there have been a couple of works out that have kind of talked about the early Chinese explorers and how they may have had some contact with the Americas.
Yeah, well, if you remember, about 1200 to 1225, somewhere along there, there was a guy by the name of Genghis Khan who was causing all kinds of problems in Asia and Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And according to the Mexican history, around 1250, a large group of people moved into central Mexico. And their leader, the people were getting really tired of traveling, and their leader said that when you see the eagle with the snake in its talons, we will stop, and that's where we will settle.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you look at the Mexican flag, it has the eagle with the snake in its talons.
Right.
Now, there's a lot of indication, and I just want your response, and correct me if you think I'm wrong, that the people who settled in Central Mexico at that time were Chinese people. Is that a probability or a possibility?
I don't think it's likely. They refer to the people that moved in. They called themselves the Chichimecs, and they were just a hunter-gatherer tribe that kind of had been, living the nomadic lifestyle. And then they believe that their god Huitzilopochtli, which means hummingbird on the left, he was the one that sort of led them to Tenochtitlan, which would be what would become Tenochtitlan, where they found the eagle on the cactus. But I don't know of any indication that would suggest that they were Chinese in origin, because all of their cultural traits really go back to the Aztec cultural traits. You can be traced back all the way back to the Olmec, back to 1,000 or even 1,500 BC, long before the Chinese could have possibly had any contact. Yeah.
Then, of course, the big question that I'm interested in is what is the probability or possibility of these people in Mexico or even Central America being direct descendants of Lehi?
Well, recently the church changed the introduction to the Book of Mormon. Back in 2009, in the introduction, it used to read that Native Americans are the principal ancestors of, that the Lamanites are the principal ancestors of Native Americans. They've actually changed that now. If you look at, LDS.org and in the Doubleday edition or new editions that are going to be coming out, it actually says that the Lamanites were among the ancestors of the Native Americans. And what that says is that there were other people here when they got here, when Lehi got here.
Yeah, I agree with that, by the way.
Okay, good. And there may be some remnants of them, but, I think what happens is, Lehi and his people get here, and they're a relatively small party, but they're moving into a continent that we just know archaeologically already had millions of people. And genetically, the DNA essentially gets lost in the mix. It gets washed out.
Be overwhelmed.
Yeah, I mean, just due to founder effect and bottlenecking and all that. The DNA just gets so diluted that it's you can't even detect it.
Well, then a real good question would be, speaking of DNA, they've gone in and started doing some DNA testing and trying to match that DNA with descendants from the Jew. And a lot of people, for example, in Mexico and Central America, do not have any resemblance at all in terms of DNA. My understanding that Ecuador and Brazil, for one reason or another, there are some similarities there. What are your feelings about that, and is that correct?
Well, no, I don't think the genetic data can tell us much. I mean, it's not surprising, again, that we're not going to find the genetic data. When you have a small group moving into a larger group, it's going to kind of get washed out. As far as there being remnants in South America, like Brazil or other areas, there is a particular genetic marker that shows some similarity to Jewish DNA. But unfortunately, we can kind of date the genetic marker, and it goes back to basically pre-Ice Age times. I mean, it's just so far distant that it can't tell us anything. And another problem is, if we're comparing modern Jewish DNA, I mean, when it comes down to it, we don't know what Lehi's DNA looked like. We're assuming he's...
That's a good point, because the modern Jewish ancestry is quite mixed.
Yeah, and then also we often fail to take into account that at the time of the Spanish conquest, because of disease, 90% of the native populations were wiped out. And so the 10% that survived, and they were wiped out because of disease, not because of, war. I mean, the war did kill off some of them, but the vast majority were killed off due to disease. So the 10% that survived shared some kind of common, genetic similarity, but 90% of pre-Columbian DNA is just gone. And so who's to say if, the portion of, Lehi DNA that may have survived was within that 90% that got wiped out.
So it's very possible that the descendants of the Lamanites could be much, much smaller than we could possibly imagine.
Yeah, exactly.
Hold on.
One final question, then. By the way, I sure appreciate, Mel's, your guest and talking about some of these things.
Mm-hmm.
There's a number of books that are starting to come out now that are starting to show of a lot of indication that where the Lamanites and Nephites really were was in upper state New York and in Ohio and that area up there.
Mm-hmm.
And they're putting forth a pretty impressive set of issues associated with that being the place. What are your impressions with those books that are coming out right now, and do you think that was probably the place where the Lamanites and Nephites were?
No, well, I actually don't think that they were up in that area for several reasons. For one, we know that the people of the Book of Mormon were a literate culture. They had books and writing, and the only area in all of the Americas that had books and writing is in Mesoamerica. Not just at that time, but I mean at any point in pre-Columbian history. There are no other literate cultures. Also, just the level of complexity, or the size of the civilizations. We just don't have the population numbers up in upstate New York. Another issue is the fact that there's never any mention of cold. Or snow, for that matter. And it talks about the Lamanites running around in, you know, in loincloths, and you're not going to be running around in upstate New York in loincloths for most of the year. You'd freeze to death.
Well, what was the weather like 1,000 years ago in the Great Lakes area?
It was the same. I mean, you look at the climate data, and it's really not very different. When you're talking about geological shifts like that, I mean, it takes, you know, tens of thousands of years to have any kind of a significant shift. Now, there are some statements from Joseph Smith, you know, when they're out on Zion's camp, where he talks about the plains of the Nephites, for example. But the only time he actually put a specific place name to from the Book of Mormon to a real-world location was in an editorial article he wrote in the Times and Seasons. And we know through stylistic analysis that he was the author of that editorial. And he said, if you want to find Zarahemla, it's right where the Nephites left it, down by, you know, in Quirigua in Guatemala. Now, so why would he speak, you know, of the plains of the Nephites, for example, when they're on Zion's camp march? Well, at the end of the Book of Alma, we see a massive northward migration. It talks about 5,400 men, plus their women, plus their children. That's, you know, 15,000, 20,000 people. And it says they go northward, and we never hear from them again. And I think that they probably established, you know, colonies or outposts or whatever you want to call it up in the north. But again, they're outside of the scope of the Book of Mormon from that time forth. So, yes, they could be considered Nephites.
And there are some interesting Cherokee traditions, for example, of language similarities to Hebrew. But as you say, they're outside the purview of the Book of Mormon.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that Joseph Smith made comments about Zarahemla being in Guatemala.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
Yeah, you'll find that in the Times and Seasons. It was in the September 15th and October 1st in 1842 of Times and Seasons.
Hmm.
So his views seem to have kind of been shifting and evolving. So, you know, some people say, no, it was all Mesoamerica. Joseph never thought anything other than that. But he really was kind of more of a hemispheric, you know, as more men, his ideas seem to have expanded a little bit. But he never really got so excited about the geography of the Book of Mormon until he saw this. He got a hold of some volumes called Incidents of Travel in Central America and Yucatan by John Lloyd Stevens and Frederick Catherwood, which was published in 1841.
Appreciate your call, Kent. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. Ivan, let me give the phone number again. That's 801 area, of course, 254-5855. Ivan, your turn.
Yeah, I got a question for the doctor, for the professor there. What about this red-haired giant that inhabited America before even the Indians came to? What's his knowledge out of it? And I'll listen out there. Thank you.
I'm sorry. I'm afraid I couldn't understand you through the speakers. Could you repeat that?
Well, I think he left us. That's too bad.
Could you hear what the question was?
Yeah, he was asking about the giant that...
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's actually very common in early archaeology. When you find a skeleton that's been buried, they become naturally disarticulated. When the flesh wears off and the bones settle, they tend to spread out a little bit. And so in the early days of exploration, I wouldn't even call it archaeology, when people would find these bones, you know, you take someone that's, you know, 5'7", and it looks like they're 8 feet tall just because of the way the bones settle. And so there is sort of this misperception, you know, 100 years ago, you know, by some of these early explorers that there used to be giants that inhabited the land. But that's just, you know, when we actually reconstruct the skeletons, we realize that they're, you know, on average 5'5 to 5'7". Every once in a while you get somebody that was about 5'10", like King Pakal from Palenque, for example.
Hmm. Interesting. I have seen photographs on the internet, which I laugh at because you can do anything with Photoshop. Mm-hmm. But it does look like they are skeletons of giants. Mm. But no archaeological evidence of that?
No. Again, those are just normal-sized skeletons that, you know, the way you present them can make them look a little bit bigger than they really are.
Caller, your first name, please.
Matt.
Matt, welcome. You're on K-Talk.
I was just wondering, you mentioned the Zion's Camp, and there was also an incident on Zion's Camp where Joseph Smith, they found some human remains, and he said it was a Lamanite chieftain named Zelph. Mm-hmm. I was just wondering if he could comment on that as well. What, you know, any ideas on that?
Yeah. So he mentioned it was this. According to some accounts, there's seven different accounts of that from those that were on Zion's Camp.
Hold that thought. Don't go away, Matt. We've got a pause for commercial, and then we'll give you a full answer to that right afterwards. You're listening to Drive Time Live, the Mills Crenshaw Show on K-Talk. Telephone number 254. 5855.
AM 630 K-Talk, the voice of Utah. Drive Time Live with Mills Crenshaw.
Welcome back. It's 3:44 in the Mountain West. Our in-studio guest, pardon me, is Dr. Mark Allen Wright, assistant professor of... Ancient scriptures. Okay, at BYU. And you were answering Matt's question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Matt had asked about on Zion's Camp that Joseph and others came across a skeleton that had an arrowhead stuck in its back, and Joseph made the comment that he was a Lamanite named Zelph, who was under the command of Commander Onondagas or Omondagas, depending on the account. And so some people question, well, doesn't that show that the Book of Mormon took place in North America? We have to keep in mind that the name Lamanite, or the term Lamanite, was sort of fluid throughout the Book of Mormon. Early in the Book of Mormon, you know, a Lamanite was anybody that was sort of against the Nephites. Later we have Alma's description of Lamanites as anybody that believed like a Nephite. But by those general definitions, it's almost like the distinction between Jew and Gentile. You're either a Jew or you're everybody else. And so by that definition, every other inhabitant of North America could be considered a Lamanite. I just want to point out that, you know, there is no Zelph in the Book of Mormon. There's no Onondagas in the Book of Mormon. And so I think these are, they're obviously... characters that are external to the Book of Mormon. And I think just as there was a migration of, you know, Nephites northward, that likewise there was sort of this, you know, you could correctly call them Lamanites by the Nephites' own internal definitions. But I don't think that they had anything to do with the core narrative of the Book of Mormon.
Yeah, it doesn't mean that they're a direct ancestor at all.
Yeah, or that they had any, you know, had anything to do with any of the narratives of the Book of Mormon. And, you know, and the bones of Zelph are, I mean, obviously very, very late. I mean, you know, they're walking around finding this essentially on the surface, you know, in the mid-1800s. And the narrative of the Book of Mormon, you know, wraps up, you know, in 400 AD. I mean, the final battle at Cumorah was around 385. And there's no way that bones from a Lamanite from the main time frame of the Book of Mormon are still going to be around, you know, even surviving, let alone on the surface, you know, 1,400 years later.
Matt, good question. Thank you for it.
Thanks, Matt.
Bye-bye.
All right, thanks.
254-5855 is the number. Next up is Ned. Ned, welcome to K-Talk.
Welcome. I have a question for Dr. Wright.
Okay.
Good. I'm curious about the translation of the Mayan record. Was there some type of Rosetta Stone found, or how many different dialects there were, and how they figured out the process of translating the records? And also about the second Hill Cumorah idea. There's one in New York and one in Central America, in Honduras or Guatemala. If you could talk about that.
Okay, sure. Yeah. So as to the first question about the decipherment, it's actually kind of a little bit of a lengthy story. But there is a Russian linguist named Yuri Konorosov, that he was kind of the first to figure out that these things were, phonetic. It really traces back to a Spanish friar in the mid-16th century named Diego de Landa. He sat a native informant down one time and said, I want you to write down your alphabet. And the first thing the Maya informant wrote in Mayan was "ma incati," which means "I don't want to." But then he asked him to, he said, write the letter A, write the letter B. But there was some miscommunication, and so when he said, write the letter L, for example, in Spanish, the letter L, it would be the equivalent of him writing T-H-E-L-E-T-T-E-R, L. So he was writing the letter L because of the miscommunication. There was this kind of this basic attempt at making an alphabet, again, in the mid-1600s, but nobody really thought anything of it, that the manuscript was lost for a few centuries, and it ended up in the hands of this Russian linguist who happened to have taught himself Yucatec Mayan, which is one of 31 Mayan dialects that still survive today. There's still millions of Mayans around, by the way. They didn't disappear mysteriously. They're still around. It's just their civilization collapsed. And the same Russian linguist was able to get a copy of one of the four pre-Columbian codices. And in this alphabet that was created by Diego de Landa and his informant, the misunderstanding was he thought that each letter had a correlate in the Mayan glyphs. But the problem is Mayan glyphs are syllabic, so each symbol will either represent an entire word or a full syllable. So they didn't have the letter L. They had la, le, li, lo, lu. So it was ba, be, bi, bo, bu. It's each, and you would combine the syllables rather than individual letters. But anyways,
Translation was not straightforward.
Right. And so in one of these codices, he sees a picture of a turkey hanging from a tree and a picture of a dog hanging from a tree. And he knew that the Yucatec word for turkey was kutz, and the Yucatec word for dog was tsul. And he noticed that the last glyph underneath the turkey looked the same as the first glyph underneath the dog. And so he figured, well, I wonder if that makes a TZ sound, since kutz and tsul, the ending sound of kutz is the same as the beginning sound of tsul. And he's like, well, if that's the case, then the second glyph under the dog must make an L sound. And then he went back to Diego de Landa's grammar from, several hundred years before, and sure enough, there was a glyph that started with L for the letter L that was the same as the one underneath the dog. And so he said, okay, well, that must mean this first glyph is tsu, and the second glyph is lu. And then he's like, well, if that's the case, then the first glyph under the turkey must make a ku sound, because the turkey is pronounced kutz. And then sure enough, he finds a glyph similar to that in the Diego de Landa manuscript. And then from there on, it was just kind of finding and replacing, looking for pictures of things he recognized, and then swapping and replacing it. And so these pictures often had captions. It'd be like if you see a picture of President Obama shaking hands with the troops, and underneath it says President Obama shaking hands with the troops. It tells you exactly what's going on. And so we just looked for illustrations that had captions under it, and then just started swapping and replacing with words that he knew. And so the main translation came through Yucatec Mayan, but we now know through better research that the closest descendant Maya language is Chorti, which is only spoken by about 2,000 people over in eastern Guatemala and western Honduras.
Interesting. Does that have anything to do with the Popol Vuh?
The Popol Vuh is actually a Quiche document. And so that's actually a completely different dialect. Now, a lot of what we see in the we read in the Popol Vuh, we can find similar, iconography. We can find pictures, drawings from earlier in Maya period that may make allusions to this Popol Vuh. But one sense that we've come to just in the last few years is that there's been kind of an over-reliance on the Popol Vuh as sort of a rubric for understanding everything that happened in the classic period. So what we have to keep in mind is each of these cities is kind of a city-state unto itself, and they each have their own local mythologies. And so really the Popol Vuh is most accurately described as a local creation narrative or mythology for the Quiche or the Highland Maya living in that particular area, and doesn't necessarily tell us a whole lot about the lowland Maya of Guatemala, for example.
Interesting. And if you could talk about the Tucamora thing.
Yeah. So we need to keep in mind that the Camorra in New York was not called Camorra until long after the Book of Mormon came forth. And it began to be called Camorra in honor of the hill in the Book of Mormon. And I think it's no more the Kimura of the Book of Mormon than Bountiful Utah is the Bountiful of the Book of Mormon. You know, it's named in honor of it. And in fact, in Mormon chapter 6, verse 6, Mormon makes it pretty clear. He says, I buried all of the plates in Kimura except for this record, which I'm passing on to my son Moroni. And he doesn't want to bury it in Kimura because that land is being overrun by Lamanites. And he wants to give it to his son to kind of get him as far away from there as he possibly can. And it really wouldn't make sense for Moroni to then take those plates that his father didn't want to bury in Kimura because it was being overrun by Lamanites and then bury him in that selfsame hill. Moroni wandered for, you know, 35 or 36 years after the battle at Kimura before he ended up finally burying the plates. And I think he, you know, took his father's advice and got as far away from there as he could. And so, again, the Kimura, New York, is just named in honor of the Book of Mormon. And we know that the main repository of the majority of the plates was in Kimura, but that the plates that became the Book of Mormon were actually not buried in the hill that the Nephites called Kimura.
Okay, well, that's good. Is there any, well, what's the most current explanation of where the real Kimura is now?
South. Yeah, some people will put their finger on a map.
That's pretty precise.
Oh, well, some people will put their finger on a map, but you know, I don't think we have enough information. There's a debate whether the Usumacinta River or the Grijalva River is the River Sidon. And you know, I've seen good arguments both ways. I don't know that I'm convinced by one or the other, but I am convinced that Mesoamerica is the right place.
Okay.
Good. Hey, appreciate the call.
Thanks for the question.
Thank you very much, Ned. Darrell, thank you very much for getting our guest for us today and for all your hard work.
Thank you. He's been a fun one.
Yes.
Thanks.
Oh, by the way, Keith, you were next and you dropped off. I hope you will call back. Go ahead, Darrell.
Okay. My understanding from my own research is that some calendar island systems have five unlucky days and traditions where they go off and hide themselves in the woods, and if the earthquakes and storms and different things like that don't repeat, then they understand that the gods have given them another lease on life, whether it be the 52 calendar round system or other traditions like the Mayan princess, the little Xochitl, 16th century Mayan prince that talked about traditions of a great destruction eclipse that came before the fair god appeared. Is that your understanding, too?
Well, yeah. So there was the five unlucky day period that would happen at the end of every year. So they had a main 360-day calendar that was based on 20 days times, 18, the numbers 1 through 18. Kind of like we have, you know, seven name days, Monday through Sunday, that cycle with the numbers 1 through 30 or 31 or, you know, depending on the month. They had these 20 name days that cycled with the numbers 1 through 18. And then at the end, there were sort of five leftover days, and they called that the Wayeb. And so those were kind of these unnamed days. Now, as far as Ixtlilxochitl, he was very, very late. I mean, he's getting into the 16th or the 17th or 18th century, and he's heavily influenced by Catholic beliefs and practices, and throughout his manuscript you can see the influence of Catholicism in there, and so we really have to be very careful with him,
right,
as reading back into earlier Maya history. Now, as far as the the cycles, I'm trying to remember, how did you word it as far as the
Five unlucky days from the traditions that I've and research I've did, where they believe that that the returning destruction could happen unless they went off into the woods. And then if nothing happened, then the gods have given them another lease on life. In other words, the destruction and the end of the world wasn't set in stone. The cycle could start all over again.
Darrell, unfortunately, we are at the top of the hour, so you're going to have to get the answer to that after the top of the hour news.
Okay.
I assume you'll stay with us, Doctor.
Sure thing, no problem.
Excellent. Hey, again, great work, Darrell. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Appreciate it.
Bye.
Okay, we're going to pause for top of the hour news. Then we'll be back with my guest, Dr. Mark Allen Wright. And I'm surprised nobody has asked anything specifically about the circular calendar and what it does portend.
Right.
So we'll get into that again at the top of the next hour. My in-studio guest is Dr. Mark Allen Wright, Assistant Professor of Ancient Scriptures at Brigham Young University. And we appreciate very much, Doctor, your being here and staying over with us the second hour.
Glad to be here.
Did you want to finish anything from the last hour before we take our next call?
I don't think so. I'm trying to remember if there was a question that we didn't finish answering. Or?
Well, you were in the process of answering Durrell's question, and I think you pretty much got through it.
Okay.
But let's go back to the phones. Telephone number, by the way, 254-5855. That's in the 801 area, of course. Again, 254-5855. Carl, welcome to K-Talk.
Oh, hi. Now, you're a professor of what?
Of ancient scripture at Brigham Young University.
Okay, and the Mayan language is just sort of a sideline?
My PhD is actually in Mesoamerican archaeology. I just finished that last year at UC Riverside, which is actually one of the best programs in the country for Mesoamerican studies.
Yeah. Now, regarding the Mayas, how many gods did they worship?
Oh, they had a huge pantheon. Yeah, you can't even put a number on it. Yeah, we're talking about hundreds.
Yeah, I one time read they had 129, but that's been a long time ago. It may have increased by then. Now, you know, you have read A Forest of Kings by Linda Scheel?
Yeah, Linda Scheele, yeah. She passed away about 10, 15 years ago. I've read it. It's now pretty outdated. When she wrote that book.
Oh, I believe that, too. You know, she does mention, you know, a chronological history of the Mayas. I'm sure, you know, they've discovered a lot more since then.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
You know, I'm 120 A.D. is the first deciphered object on one of these steles. Is that still correct?
We can actually push that back a little farther now. We have the San Bartolo murals that were just discovered a few years ago, in fact, after Linda Scheele passed away. It's got a handful of glyphs on it. We can actually decipher a couple of those. And so
yeah, what's the date on that, then?
It's about 100 B.C., give or take.
Yeah, she does mention that, you know, the first Mayan writing was about 100 B.C., but... is there anything indicating on any steles of what happened around 33 A.D. when allegedly Jesus Christ visited the Americas?
Well, you know, there's actually not a whole lot of anything from that time period. Unfortunately, the early classic stuff doesn't preserve very well. Most of the monuments were carved on limestone, and it's a very, the rains are pretty constant there a couple times a year. You know, they have a major rainy season. And so even things from, you know, the late classic period, you know, 7, 8, 900 A.D., even those are sometimes hard to read because they're so completely eroded.
Yep.
And so, you know, you have to keep in mind we've excavated less than 1% of what's down there. And that number is coming from George Stewart, by the way, who is the Mayanist on staff at National Geographic. I was just talking to him last year about this, and I asked him, you know, how much have we dug up, and you know, he said less than 1%. So there's a whole lot that we haven't dug up yet.
Yeah.
Even when we do dig them up, most of them are so eroded that we can tell that they had writing on them, but we can't read anything that was there.
Well, would you agree that just about all of the big cities of the Mayas have been discovered?
No, not at all. In fact, thanks to satellite imagery, just in the last few years, we know of about 6,000 Maya sites that are still buried underneath the jungle. And of those, we've done a partial excavation of a few dozen of them, and none of them have been fully excavated. To excavate a site is actually to destroy it, really. Once you dig it up, it exposes it to the elements. And so unless you have a really good reason for digging up, you know, one site over another, we actually prefer to leave it in the ground. But,
yeah.
I mean, there are thousands upon thousands upon thousands of sites that we haven't dug up and we never will dig up because, A, there's no funding for it, and, B, you know, unless you can have a really good reason why, you know, this site is going to have something that the other site doesn't have, it's just not going to be excavated.
Well, I mean, with your interest in this area, have you discovered even one shred of evidence in the Maya culture that would tend to prove the Book of Mormon?
Well, the nature of proof, I mean, that's, I think there's mounds of evidence. But when it comes to proof, I mean, we can't really prove anything. I mean, even if you just look at the Maya literature, you know, Mayanists talking to Mayanists about what the Mayans did, there's huge debates, you know, on every corner. And so, you know, I do have an active interest in Book of Mormon archaeology. But I'm not out to prove the Book of Mormon true, but I am out to prove it interesting. And there are a lot of interesting pieces of evidence out there. Just cultural parallels, convergences, if you want to call them that. That's a William Deaver's term with biblical archaeology. But, you know, this fact that you've got books and writing, a literate culture. You've got, large stones with engravings on it. Many of the cultural aspects that are described in the Book of Mormon, especially among apostate Nephites, for that matter, can be found in Mesoamerica.
Well, now, getting back to 33 A.D., isn't that that's the year that Jesus allegedly appeared to the people on this continent? Is there anything in Mayan writings or any other kind of evidence that indicates they were visited by Jesus? And then why would they still believe in hundreds of gods?
Well, I mean, like I said, there are no, as far as I know, there's maybe, you know, one or two texts that even date to the first century. And as I've mentioned at the beginning of the program, each one of these Maya cities had their own beliefs and practices. They worshiped their own set of gods. Many of them actually had a primary set of three gods that they worshiped. So you have, you know, if you look in Shealy's book that you mentioned, A Forest of Kings, she talks about the Palenque Triad. We don't even know how to read the names of those gods. We call them G1, G2, and G3 because we don't know how to read their names. But Naranjo also had a triad that was different from Palenque's triad. Caracol had a triad that was different from both of those. Tikal had a triad. And so we've got all these different cities where they're worshiping different gods, and oftentimes a set of three principal gods. And so the Nephites, you know, they would have stood out if they tried to copy another city's gods. But by the virtue of the fact that they had their own, if we want to call it a triad, of Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, that actually would have made them fit in by having their unique triad that was unique to their own city and their mythology.
Well, now, in terms of the Mayan writing, I mean, Mayan writing has absolutely no relationship with any other type of writing in the world. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, so how come we haven't found Hebrew writing anywhere in the Americas or anything resembling Egyptian? Or have you ever seen that picture of these characters that Joseph Smith wrote down for Martin Harris to take to Dr. Anthon? Nothing like that has ever appeared in the Americas, isn't that correct?
Yeah, that manuscript you're referring to, actually, we don't have good provenance on that. That was found among the objects of David Whitmer, but there's no indication there's no documentation saying that was the manuscript that was taken to Charles Anthon. People have attributed it to that. But there's actually, that was just an assumption. There was absolutely no evidence or any statements from David or anyone else connecting that manuscript to the one that was taken to Charles Anthon. In fact, if you look at the accounts by Charles Anthon, he actually mentions that there were, you know, Central American-style glyphs on the manuscript that Martin Harris brought to him.
Well, I mean, how many years was that after the fact?
Well, see, that's the thing, is that that manuscript was found among David Whitmer's objects after he died. So we're talking about years and years and years.
Yeah, sure. But the Dr. Anthon statement, didn't Dr. Anthon think that Martin Harris was a screwball?
Well, that was Charles Anthon's account. But the reason why we should believe Martin's account is because he put his money where his mouth was. The whole reason he went to New York was to get verification that Joseph wasn't trying to take him for a ride. Martin himself admitted to being a man of little faith, and I don't see him coming back and mortgaging his farm for $5,000 in the Book of Mormon if Anthon's account is correct rather than Martin Harris's account.
Well, the type of characters on that David Whitmer document, they aren't like anything in the Americas. I mean, they're basically English-type letters, sometimes reversed, just maybe three vertical lines, whatever that means. They're they're basically worthless, aren't they?
Well, yeah, but what I'm saying is you're assuming that that's the manuscript that was taken to Jarl Sandthun, and there's no indication that it was. We have no idea what those characters are or where they came from.
So you're assuming
that those were the ones that were taken to Martin Harris, but there's no evidence for that whatsoever.
Well, there, it's also a fact that, the Book of Mormon allegedly is written in, deformed Egyptian?
No, the word is reformed.
Reformed, I'm sorry. There was nothing Egyptian then on whatever Martin Harris took to...
But why does that matter? What I'm telling you
is that... Well, it does matter.
Does it matter if... That's not the manuscript. I'm telling you that's not the manuscript that Martin Harris took to Charles Anthon. You're assuming it is, but I'm telling you that it's not.
Well, I'm saying is that Joseph Smith makes the claim that the plates are in reformed Egyptian, and he copies some of these characters onto a piece of paper, which Martin Harris takes to the good doctor, and... the doctor cannot confirm that any of this stuff was Egyptian.
Well, that's according to Charles Anthon's account, but Martin
Harris's
account...
Yeah, I believe him better than I do a nutcase like Martin Harris.
Well, why would Martin Harris put $5,000 of his own money back then to fund the Book of Mormon when the whole point he went to see Charles Anthon was to get confirmation?
Well, I think he was in...
I'm sorry, Carl, are you still there? Hello? I'm sorry, Carl, are you still there?
I'm still here.
Okay, finish your sentence. I'm sorry.
I'm saying that Martin Harris was part of the con that Joseph Smith put up.
Does that make any sense to you, Doctor?
I think Carl's wrong. I could agree with you, but then we'd both be wrong.
Durrell, welcome. You're on K-Talk again. Thank you.
Yes. I'd like to spend an hour just getting into evidences, but I do have a question. It's about the seven manic symbol. Rolls around on the calendar around until it matches up with a bar with two dots with a grasping hand type symbol. Mm-hmm. And my question is that why is there a lot of vases that show the headband twins resurrecting the corn dog, or corn god, excuse me, with different types of hand and wrist grasps, like in what we see in resurrection scenes in early Toledo Christian artworks?
Well, one thing with the seven manic date, we shouldn't read too much into that. I know some people they look at the manic sign, which is, you know, it's one of their days of the week, kind of like, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, or whatever. And so the manic sign is a hand, and in the corner of the hand, there are two concentric circles. And some have suggested that you know, looks like a piercing or a wound that would be reflective of the wounds of Christ. But unfortunately, that's just shows. The Maya use that on any body part, you know, whether they're showing a hand or a finger or an arm or a leg or a head. That just indicates that it's a body part, and it shows the point of articulation. So in other words, on the head, it would be on the back of the head where the head connects to the neck. On the hand, like in the Monique hand, it's kind of where the wrist would be to show that it articulates, you know, that there's basically a joint there.
Could it be a death spot?
What's that?
Could it be a death spot?
No, it's not a death spot. We see the same thing, you know, again, it's just on it's just the Maya's way of indicating that that it was a body part. So it's not even intended to be to indicate anything other than it's a body part. I know some people have tried to suggest that it, you know, is the wounds of resurrection. But that's unfortunately not the case.
Darrell, we've got a commercial break again. Was there anything else?
Yeah, there are traditions about the third God returning too, right?
Okay, hold on. We'll let you finish that right after this commercial break. You're listening to Drive Time Live, the Mills Crenshaw Show on K-Talk.